technical hitch, but I understand it's now fully addressed, and we've overcome that. It has become particularly important this morning that we have all the technical systems up and running. And just to ensure that we also have a transcript of this particular meeting, we have asked Mr. Hermans to address that particular point for us as well. So we will have that. We'll not only have, of course, the hard copy of the presentation, but we will also make available to members later a transcript of what was said at the meeting this morning, which we don't always do. This is a very important process as we come to the end of the public hearings in the company's amendment bill, piece of legislation coming up before us. And we have before us on our left, we have the DDG, Ms. Zodwa Ntuli and her team. Of course, we have the committee here on the right. And with us, just to indicate, we have Mr. Pema, who is also one of our consultants. And we also have an apology from the consultant who will be assisting us on the legal side and the draft, and that is Miss Kathy Idenson from the Cape Town University, whom we mentioned her CV last week to members, an expert in this particular area. Also, here on my right, as I said, we've got Mr. Zodwa Ntuli, the Deputy Director General, Mr. McDonald Nyetsi Tenzi, the Director Commercial Law and Policy, Advocate Rory Voller, Director Legal and Regulatory Services of the Companies and IP Registration Office, Advocate Flip Dwinger, Legal Consultant Cipro, and Mr. Desmond Ramabulani, Deputy Director, Commercial Law and Policy, CCRD. I should just Advocate Mandla Inyateli, Chief Director, Office of Company and Intellectual Property Law Enforcement, as well with us. We have apologies, members, from Honourable Khwabasa, who is attending by election in KZN. It is not often we release members for party political work, but this is an actual by election itself. Honourable Smalley admitted to hospital, food poisoning. Now, which restaurant was he at? Honourable Labenya and Tanzi attending another meeting. I'm not aware of the actual meeting involved, I'm sorry. Honourable Mpashlele, not attending this week due to party commitments, but of course he is one person who has about 14 to 20 committees that he is a member of and has to attend. Advocate Albert's party commitments. I do think in future our party commitments we have to be a little bit more specific, as it were, like by elections or annual general conference or something. So if we can ensure that we do that in future. Otherwise, I may have, in fact, excused myself on a party political meeting, of which I have several. Anyway, the rest of you are all very welcome. Thank you very much for being here. We now will have the responses from the Department of Trade and Industry with respect to the public hearings on the company's amendment bill. So we will immediately hand over to the department. But on that note, we also are aware that we're a little bit, 20 minutes or so beyond the time we expected to start. We would have had a tea break in an hour's time, so we will arrange to have that tea break a little bit later, 20 minutes later, than is scheduled, and that will be done. So we will continue until the tea break with the actual responses. Do you think that'll be sufficient time, though, DDG? If we give you from now, which is 5 to 10, until 20 past 11. Right, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. And as usual, we are pleased to be in this committee. It is a committee that we don't mind coming to because this is our daily job. This is what we do every day. And we're always happy to come in front of this committee. And one thing that we obviously appreciate as a department is that whatever proposal that we bring to this committee is not a proposal of the department. We are not speaking for the department. We're speaking for this country. We're speaking for the stakeholders. We're speaking for a whole lot of people. And I think I must also repeat again what I said the last time, that the difficulty of us as a department is that we are so central, and we get comments from all over the stakeholders in the process of finalizing the proposals that we bring here. And we do our utmost best to balance that. But I think like any other piece of legislation, you would not be in a position to agree with each and every interpretation that comes to the table. Sometimes we spend the whole day in a meeting with stakeholders arguing on interpretation of one particular provision, and we find that there's like more than 10 interpretations in one room. And I think that's one of the things that actually says to us that as much as we come up with proposals, I think we need to also allow the space for our courts to play their role, because that's why they're there. Our courts are there to interpret the laws that this parliament will do. And yes, we will accept also on our part that, yes, it is important to do a thorough job. And that's what we're trying to do at all times. But then we must accept at some point that we will not have one particular interpretation. Every little provision can be interpreted differently. So we are here today basically to respond to some of the issues that have been raised in the public hearings. And I must acknowledge the team that is here. Again, Chair, you've already indicated their names, but I just want to apologize that Advocate Rory Voller is not with us today, could not make it, but everybody else is here. Chair, before I get into the presentation itself, I think we just want to explain the process that we underwent just with this amendment. We did go widely in terms of soliciting public comments, soliciting people's views in terms of the areas in the 2008 Act which they think that might have some errors that might affect its interpretation and therefore undermine the objective. I think the main thing is for us to ensure that whatever error exists in this legislation, the Companies Act 71 of 2008, if there is an error, we appealed to everybody publicly, widely, and said, if you read it and you see something, please bring it to the attention of the department. That's where we started the process, where then we got all of the comments from the stakeholders, from the public in general, and then we started, you know, categorizing them according to the areas and to see whether indeed what people have raised are issues that have got to do with errors or are issues that open up new policy issues or that go and open up debates that were closed in the parliamentary process that took place in adopting the 71 of 2008. So the process, we did not miss a step in doing that. We confined the scope, and whatever we're doing was within the scope. So as we come now to this parliament and their public comments, there would be public comments that are outside the scope that as a department we had put to say this is what we are seeking to correct. So for those that are things that are outside the scope, we still believe that this parliament, because it is the parliament that's got the mandate to make the laws, can make its own decision in terms of whether they take those on board or they do not take on board. However, we'll give our views in terms of some of those issues that have been raised if they relate to policy issues. But I think the scope has been clarified initially with the stakeholders. We consulted broadly. We had workshops with all the stakeholders after publishing and soliciting views. We had workshops with stakeholders. We had one-on-one meetings with stakeholders. A whole lot of stakeholders that came here to present are stakeholders that we had one-on-one meetings with them following their comments so that we can understand the issues that they're raising, we can appreciate the angle that they're coming from, and so that we can also then be in a position whether we should propose any corrections to that effect. And so that process did happen. And as we were doing this, Chair, we had two teams in terms of drafting. We have the external drafting team, which comprised of Judge Dennis Davis, Phil Knight, and Professor Tepo Mongalo. Those are the people that have always been providing advice to the internal team. So the other side, the second team comprised of the internal people, which are these people that are sitting here, who are responsible for this area of work. And at all times, we've been conferring with each other in terms of some of the issues. So it has been an extensive process as well. But over and above that, what we've done is that we have solicited views of other experts that are not on the team, so that we can also balance. And we've got the Standing Advisory Committee on Companies Act, which we've also requested for their input in this process. So we can say to you confidently that we have done a thorough job. And I think whatever areas that still come up, you know, that suggest that there may be some, maybe an area that needs improvement there and there, should not detract from the fact that we've got one of the best pieces of legislation in the corporate law environment. And I think we should not detract from that. Yes, there may be areas that would need to improve, but this is one of the best legislation that any country can ever have. And I think it's progressive enough, and we think as a department that if it's properly implemented, we will derive the benefits that we thought to derive in the policy objectives when we proposed this legislation. So I will stop on that, the Chair, in regard to that, setting the tone for our responses today. And just to indicate as well, Chair, that we have prepared a document, a word document, which would want to request the committee to indulge us and allow us to circulate that document tomorrow. It covers all of the areas that have been raised and puts responses, because some of the issues are smaller issues, drafting issues, which we agree with. Some of the issues are issues that we don't agree with, but we've mentioned, but they're minor issues. So in the presentation, we just uplifted the main issues. However, we will take questions and respond to some of those minor issues if the committee members have got questions on that. So accept that the document will circulate it tomorrow, if the committee can indulge us on that. Chair, I've explained the process. So I think the remaining things for us to do really is to go into the issues. And but I just want to mention as well, I'm going to skip this slide, the first five slides, and get into the slide number six, to say that when stakeholders were commenting in this committee, we did identify that there are areas where they commented where you find that the issues they are raising are issues that we are dealing with under the regulations. So we will not seek to address those issues, as Tess said, because we think that the regulations process is still underway. I think all of us are aware that the closing date for comments is still on that. It's the 31st of this month. So, and we've already started engaging on one-on-one meetings with stakeholders. We've been having a series of meetings in December. We're having a series of meetings now in January, so that even once we've received the comments, we sort of already have engaged the stakeholders that have got issues to input to us. And we must say that we also appreciate the extent to which the stakeholders have engaged with us. I think with this, dealt with us, you know, in a very credible manner, I must say, you know, because I think the more we consulted, the more we engaged, the more we got this legislation enriched. And I think that's the best process you can ever have. And I just want to also say that when we proposed this legislation at the time, there are benefits that from the policy perspective we wanted to achieve. And we still believe this legislation achieves that. And there may be potential harm or unintended consequences, and it is our view that if such arises, we should not ignore it. We need to deal with it. And I think that is why we are here, because we realize that some of the errors that are in that legislation, it may be that if we don't address them and it sits in the front of a judge the judge might interpret it differently, and then it might undermine the intention. So, which is why we're here. So it is our belief that we need to correct things if we are able to identify them earlier. But also, there were issues that were raised around the cost of complying with certain provisions of this Act. We just want to also say that from a department's perspective, we do believe that each and every legislation that you put in place would have some cost. But what we need to ask ourselves is whether the cost is unreasonable, is unjustifiable. And we can only do that if we are able to quantify what the cost is going to be. Because we never do legislation, for instance, as Parliament, you would never do legislation that that is intended to harm people and just increase the cost of doing business exorbitantly. So, but we do believe that we need to quantify that. And when we find that the cost might be really unreasonable, we need to look at it. I mean, the Banking Association did put an issue on the table to say, recognizing symbols from a technology perspective that they're using, it might mean to overhaul their entire systems, the ATMs and all of that. So I think it's incumbent of all of us to look at the merit of that. And if it has merit to that, then we need to ameliorate that. And so those are the things that we think, I think, as a responsible department, we also need to bring to our attention. Okay, we've got the issues outlined per slide. We'll start with some of the areas which I will cover, and I will hand over to my colleague McDonald to cover the last part of the presentation. We've had a number of comments relating to the issue of audits, but there are specific issues that were raised with us, and unfortunately, I must say, Chair, that some of the issues that came to this committee during the public hearings, as a department, we did not have the opportunity to engage the stakeholders on them, because some of the stakeholders identified them at the last minute. And at that time, we already had to process certain documents and all of that, but we agreed to say that if they still have issues with those areas, they have an opportunity to come here. So I must say that some of the things, yes, we appreciated the extent of it, we appreciated the nature of the concern, and then we said to them, look, We understand where you're coming from. I mean, where we agree with you, we'll indicate that we agree with you, and I think we're at that point right now. The first comment that we are addressing here is the comment that says that subsidiaries of foreign companies may be substantial companies, but in the legislation right now, they are not required to be audited. So we have considered that that suggestion, and we are saying that it was not intended that it would apply like that. I mean, if you are a subsidiary of a foreign company, and you are here in South Africa, and in terms of the impact of your operations, the size of your workforce, you actually are supposed to be audited if you were a South African company. We believe that the same treatment should be applied. So, which means that we agree that, in fact, there should be some amendment just to make that clear, because it would appear that it's not clear enough. So we think that to the extent that we should make that clear so that we avoid misinterpretation and different interpretation of this particular clause, that Section 32 to be slightly amended to reflect that equal treatment will be given to those companies. And similarly, where, for instance, our legislation relieves a company, a South African company, from an audit, the same should apply to a foreign company which is in South Africa if it fits that threshold which justifies the relaxation. So we do agree with that comment entirely. So the other aspect was in regards to, again, the verification of annual financial statement. I must say, Chair, that I think during the public hearings, there were statements that were made to suggest that this Act takes away the responsibility of companies to prepare and have financial statements. And we still want to emphasize, this Act does not do that. Every company will still be required to prepare financial statements. The only thing that is different is that some companies may not be required to have them audited. Some may be required to have them only to be independently reviewed. And some may then be relieved of that particular requirement completely. So, but everybody has the responsibility to keep the financial statements. They must prepare them. So I think to the extent that particular suggestion may have been conveyed by the presentations before. We are just wanting to re-emphasize that. So in this regard, the comment that was being made here is that because the Act suggests that companies whereby the shareholders are also the directors. So if you are a shareholder and you are also the director of this company, so the directors and the shareholders are one and the same person. In that case, they think that you still must subject the financial statements to the same verification process where it gets to be prepared, approved by the board, and approved by the shareholders. So we should not relax that process for the purposes of verification. And what we're saying here, Chair, is that we welcome the proposals that they're putting on the table because I think really it is important that for accountability purposes that verification needs to follow the relevant process because some of the things, if you do not follow them to the letter, you'll find that technically, from a legal perspective, you are unable to enforce certain things because you have not specifically said that the shareholders must approve the financial statements to show that they've looked at them, they see them, they can say and attest that this is the state of affairs of this company. So we are saying that, yes, for accountability purposes, we recommend that a minor amendment could be effected to just make that clear again. So again, we're saying that this is not a policy matter. These are matters just to clarify certain areas that when people are looking at them, they feel that maybe there is actually a vacuum and which might impact on the accountability principles that we are seeking to achieve here. One of the other concerns, Chair, that was raised was that the process or the dispensation of independent review does not make provision for reportable irregularities under the auditing the Auditing Professions Act. You have that obligation that auditors have got to report certain irregularities if they come across them. And so, if the independent reviewer is reviewing the company and picks up some things, if that obligation is not there, then it's really inconsistent with the principles of accountability. You know, and for us to be in a position to really be assured that they are doing their job, because they if they pick up something that is inconsistent with any legislation, they must be in a position to report it to the relevant authority. So we are saying that we agree with that sentiment that says that the reportable irregularities should be part and parcel of this process, and we think that we recommend again that the committee looks at a minor amendment just to effect that particular process so that we are also applying a consistent approach to accountability. Chair, the next item, I think is a bit controversial because, you know, before it came to this committee, it's been discussed extensively in our consultation sessions. And we went back again as a department and we looked at it again, you know, because the concern that is being raised here is that, you know, people that have been convicted of fraud, dishonesty, or have been removed from positions of trust, ordinarily they would not be allowed maybe to serve. But it looks like there's an exemption that suggests that if you are a person that is, you know, you're running an owner-managed company, that you can still serve as a director in that particular company. Because I think the sentiment there was that if it's only an owner-managed company and you are the director and you've been convicted before, it doesn't do much harm. I think there was that exception, that there was that sentiment. But I must accept it, that this was debated extensively, and these guys around here also had different views at some point, and the stakeholders had put to us different views as well. But we went back to consider, and we think that as a DTI, really, we agree that we may need to reconsider this. And why we're saying that is that the areas dealing with this provision, they define the nature of the offences. And the nature of the offences, you can see they have to do with honesty issues. you know, fraudulent issues. They're not covering each and every little offense that may exist. You know, so it's not the entire group. It's not just saying that, well, if you have been convicted, you know, previously, then you cannot serve as a director. It narrows it down so that it's more targeted in terms of what is it that you're dealing with. And so we're saying that, yes, there's merit to reconsider this, but just so that we do not speak in different tongues in the same legislation. It looks like the legislation seeks to achieve higher standards of accountability, higher standards of credibility, whether for investors or for the public, but it seeks to do that. So we're saying that how do you then balance that, you know, you still manage to achieve that, but at the same time you do not preclude people from participating in economic activity because of the fact that they've been convicted before. So what we've looked at is that by law, you know, if you've got a conviction, after a period of 10 years, it falls away, in a sense. But also, we looked at the fact that you can still approach the court to apply to be allowed to actually enter into business. So there are processes. So it's not like there's no recourse for a person that is in that position. So if you can prove that you have been rehabilitated, for instance, you can show that you have been put in a position of trust where you've performed despite your conviction, you can still approach the court and say to the court, this is what I can show you. And we don't think that process is cumbersome. We don't think that it's difficult. But to the extent that it might prove difficult to other people, we think that let's look at the option of ameliorating that difficulty as opposed to actually trying to make the law to allow something that could go contrary to what we are trying to achieve. So that's where we add as a department, and we're saying that we'd look at this particular provision. But again, Chair, on this one, we still would like to confer with the state law advisors as well. And my colleagues will also add to this area when we get to the further areas of this presentation. Because at the end of the day, we still want to be in a position where we have provisions that are consistent. We've got provisions that do not contradict each other, and we'll ensure that we balance that. So what we're saying is that the owner managed company, for instance, you know, could transact with other parties, you know, including the public. So the fact that it's owner-managed doesn't mean that it cannot harm somebody else. So we should not say because it's an owner-managed company, therefore, its impact is little. It's not automatic. You know, it could be owner-managed. It could even be bigger than a company that is not owner-managed. And the harm that it could cause could be higher. You know, you could have a company that, involves itself in defrauding consumers, and all of that. So all we're saying is that let's apply the same principles and ensure that they're applied consistently. I would allow the team to elaborate on this, Chair, on the basis that we've discussed it extensively. And from the beginning, I must accept that a number of us had different views on it, even amongst ourselves, but through discussions and through input from other experts as well, we are able to find some way of recommending some proposal to this committee, and we'll do that. The area around the conversion of private shares, I think members will recall that the Companies Act introduced the provisions that basically do away with the regime of private shares. Which means that going forward, the pari-value shares would not exist anymore. So we'll have a situation where shares would be valued, you know, looking at the market, looking at what they are worth at that particular point. So I think we had an extensive discussion with National Treasury on this. And in our discussion, I'm glad to say that we did find each other on this one. Because we had a discussion on it, with the issues being that we should not allow a situation where it is compulsory or mandatory to convert your shares. So we should not force people that currently have those shares to convert them. But you perhaps should stop such shares from being issued going forward once this legislation is enforced. So, and we seem to agree with that position, and to say that Parliament perhaps should look at the same approach that it took when it was dealing with the issue around the conversion of closed corporations into companies. You'll remember that with this new legislation, the dispensation of closed corporation is going to fall off. It's not going to be allowed anymore. There isn't going to be any closed corporations that are going to be registered going forward. So, however, the existing closed corporations will be allowed to still coexist with companies and to still operate as closed corporations up until such time they decide to convert. But how the conversion would happen is that I think one of the drivers of that is going to be if this legislation, because it's supposed to be more flexible, it's supposed to even be at a level where now the closed corporations are at. It's supposed to be so easy, you know, to run a business in the manner that a closed corporation currently runs. So now the driver of the conversion is going to be when people start seeing that actually whether you're a company or a closed corporation, the system is the same. You know, you can operate as easily, you know, as if you're a closed corporation. Then they will be motivated to convert to the new dispensation. So we're thinking that even in regard to the par value shares, the conversion of these par value shares into the new dispensation, it is not perhaps necessary or even an issue of urgency to compel them to convert within a particular period of time. Because one of the issues that National Treasury raised in regard to this is that there may be some tax implications when that happens, depending on how the transfer takes place. For instance, if the transfer of those shares, the conversion of those shares, is such that the existing rights, the rights that are attached to those shares, change, then there would be a tax implication because then there would be a disposal. So, but again, at the same time, why do you want to have a forced conversion if people can convert on a voluntary basis? Other people can convert directly without affecting any rights that are attached to those shares, and then there won't be any tax implications necessarily. But if they decide to change the rights when they are converting, then the necessary scrutiny will be applied by SARS to look into that. So we're saying that we agree with National Treasury to say that perhaps the committee should consider not allow a provision that forces these shares to be converted, but to say that you will not be allowed to have such kinds of shares in the future. But should you wish to convert, this is the process of conversion and give guidance in regards to that. And I think, is it Cheryl McDonald which deals with that, the conversion issues? Yeah, Schedule 5 of the 2008 Act deals with that process. So we think that there's little amendments that we just need to put there just to take away the forced conversion part of it. But otherwise, we still are in agreement with the principle that the par value share dispensation should be done away with. The other point that came up strongly was the one that relates to business rescue processes. You recall that one of the changes that we wanted to effect related to the powers, for instance, of the business practitioner to cancel contracts and all of that. And we have proposed those changes to this committee, so they are in the bill. But one of the issues that has been raised is that because Section 133 says that no legal action should be taken against a company that is in rescue. So which means that if you've got a legal claim or action that you want to take against that company, it will be stayed up until the company is out of the rescue process. So now, one of the issues that was raised, particularly by, I think, the FSB, if I'm not mistaken, was that this provision should, however, not affect the regulator's rights. You know, if you're a regulator, if you are about to enforce action in regard to a particular company which is under business rescue, that should not be affected. And they've given examples of situations where such might be necessary. And we've looked into that, and we're saying that as the department, it was not the intention that the powers of the regulators to enforce action should be excluded. It is not the intention, and it was never the intention in the legislation itself. And we think that if you look at the legislation closely, you'll see that it also allows for circumstances under which such action can still be taken, even if the company is in risk. So it was our view that this provision is very clear. Because if you look at Section 133, subsection, I think, McDonald, the one that that explains the circumstances, it outlines, for instance, that if it's a it's an issue that is that leads to a criminal matter, that in fact that action could still commence, you know, it can still can be taken because of the nature of the issue. But it also says upfront that also with the consent of the practitioner, such action can be taken. But we appreciate the concern that is being raised by the FSB to say, as a regulator, there may be other bigger motivations to still want to enforce that without being subjected to those exceptions. So that is the area that we're looking at right now. And we're saying that, you know, perhaps the committee might want to look at just a minor clarification, really, so that the powers of the regulators is not negatively affected in those circumstances where such action really has to be taken, despite the fact that the business is under risk. All right, okay. So that is where we actually ended in terms of our deliberation as well as the department on this matter. We say that yes, we do appreciate the concern, and we do not want unintended consequences that will tie the hands of regulators as well, because the regulators also would be acting on the basis of specific mandates. And again, we must also remember that there may be potential for the business rescue process to be abused in the same way that the liquidation processes are being abused. So you might find that companies deliberately put themselves under that situation to avoid certain actions from being taken from them. So you don't want that unintended consequences that will tie the hands of the regulators like the FSB, you know, from taking action where it is required. Or, you know, it may be that maybe the action can be taken later after negotiation, but by that time, you know, the funds have been transferred to a lot of other accounts, wherever, and offshore, then it becomes now difficult to start and uncover that. But maybe the action is taken immediately by the regulator in regard to that particular area. It could salvage a whole lot of issues. Chair, I've got two more slides to take you through, and then I'll hand over to McDonald. The other area where the issue was raised, and we feel that perhaps we need to look at that again a bit more closely, in terms of Section 144, I think there's some area that might just be a bit inconsistent or not clear, in a sense that it says that voidable transactions under the business rescue process should be referred to the directors. 141 of the main act of the 2008 act. Yes, 141. So now, if you look at the various sections relating to the business rescue process, the business rescue practitioner sort of takes over the company, in a sense. But in this particular provision, it says that when there are voidable contracts, the practitioner must refer those contracts to the management to act accordingly, which means that he must or she must refer them to the management to maybe reverse them or whatever the case may be. So I think the comment that was being made here was that this in a sense might frustrate the powers of the business rescue practitioners where, for instance, the cause of this voidable contract may very well be the very same management that you are instructing or sending or referring the matter to. So it may be that the business rescue practitioner actually had got to act on those voidable contracts within the confines of the limitations that are put in place there. For instance, where he's got to cancel contracts, he must be in a position to approach the court to do that. Where he can suspend contracts, he can do that without necessarily approaching the court. So it will be within those powers. So we're saying that we agree with the issue that is being raised here. and that Terrestre should make that clear so that it does not become a must refer, but it must say that the practitioner may refer, you know, where the management is in the right position to implement the instructions. But in the case that he finds that it might not be the good idea, then he must not be compelled to refer them there. So that is just one area around the business rescue. And then the last part that I'm going to deal with under business rescue is relating to the retention of books and records under the business rescue. The comment that was being made is that no person may retain books or records of the company if required by the business rescue practitioner. And the stakeholder basically raised the concern that such action might be problematic, as it would include, for instance, that the regulator which has seized documents under a particular process through a certain seizure process would be obliged to hand over the documents to the business rescue practitioner, which might affect the chain of evidence. So we're saying that obviously the legislation could not have intended that. So in order to clarify it, we think that there should be an exception that is included in the amendment bill, whereby documents seized, I think there's an error in terms of the word that is being used there, that has been seized or obtained by way of a court process should be excluded in that particular provision, just so that we do not affect some of the processes that are in place. I think the mechanics of how we craft that chair, we would look at proposing some wording in that, and we'll talk to the stakeholders relevant to who might actually have some proposals for the committee. That's the last slide that I'm going to deal with, Chair. And this slide, again, we discussed this extensively with the National Treasury. This is a proposal that came from their side to say that we should put under the provision in Section 5.4 of the 2008 Companies Act that we must add that all financial and tax legislation should take precedence over the Companies Act in the case of conflict. And our view in regard to this has always been that we are not in support of any wholesale approach to exemptions or trumping provisions. We cannot have a legislation provision that sort of exempts everything without a closer scrutiny. A wholesale approach, we are not in favor of it. So we had a discussion with National Treasury to look at the legislation that is relevant and, you know, that they were actually concerned about when they made that proposal. And when we looked at all of that, we found that, yes, there is merit in looking at the Municipal Finance Management Act in the same manner that in Section 5.4, that provision has been made for the Public Finance Management Act. So for consistency purposes, we thought that the committee should consider including the MFMA. And also, we looked at the National Payment Systems Act, and we did identify that Section 8 of that Act does actually provide that trumping provision. So it's just a matter of migrating it into this particular area. So those are the only two legislation that we believe as a department that can be considered. And we again will caution against any wholesale approach to these kinds of things. We believe that a thorough legislative audit needs to be done on all of those other financial legislation that have been referred to. And then at any given time when this legislation is being reviewed, those could be brought to the table. Because I think comforting here is that if there is a legislation that provides for higher standards and stricter rules than the Companies Act, that is acceptable in any event. So I don't think there would be any harm if the list of the legislation has not been put there, because the Act already allows for that. It allows for, if you're providing for higher standards, then it's fine. But again, we believe that we should caution against just saying all legislation that falls in this sector should trump the Companies Act in the case of conflict. We do not believe that this is the right time to do that. We do not believe that the legislative audit that is required has been performed, but we do believe that the MFMA and the National Payment System, specifically on the Section 8 of that particular legislation, that it can be considered for that. So I'll head over now to McDonald to just cover the last slide. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair, honourable member. Mine was not difficult work. The DDG has already dealt with the most difficult part. I'm dealing with the regulation. There was a submission here, definitions of saying when you defined the expression regulatory authority, and then National Treasury requested that it would be better in the definition to include by name Financial Intelligence Center and SAS. And then if we go into the definition in the Act, it talks about sectoral or provincial regulatory authority, sectoral, provincial, and the like. And then here, therefore, we are saying the definition is wide enough to include all regulatory authorities, and therefore no amendment is requested, is not recommended, because why do we particularize a particular institution? Otherwise, we will have to exhaustively list all of them. But just to say sectoral or provincial, that will be enough. So if we go into the reading of the definition of a regulatory authority, honorable members will see that the definition is wide enough, so there is no need to tamper with that. Definition of an audit. There was a comment to say the definition of an audit by excluding an independent review as part of the definition as the consequences of amending the definition of an audit in the Audit Professions Act. The Audit Professions Act is administered by the Department of National of Finance. Maybe before we go into the issue of the request, it will be better to give a background to this thing. Is that in terms of the Audit Professions Act, it says an audit shall include independent review. An audit shall include an independent review. However, internationally, where this legislation, Audit Professions Act, I will call it APA, it draws from international jurisprudence under a certain organization called IFEC. IFEC, just allow me to use the acronym, IFEC. It draws there. Very internationally, they do have an audit. That audit has got layers. The other layer is to say there is a review that can only be conducted by a person who is an auditor. You must be an auditor in order to deal with that. But there is another one which can be performed by a person who is not an auditor. So therefore we have three layers here. Unfortunately, here at home, when we have drawn from that authoritative body, we clubbed together, we said, an audit shall include a review. Without separating those review, we are talking about there is a review that can be conducted only by an auditor, and the other one not by a person with an audit. That person may be an accountant with a cost 3 or whatever, measuring in accounting and the like. So here at home, we clubbed all of them together. So when the DTI came to Parliament in 2008 to say, we would like to introduce independent review, we came with a clear mandate of saying there is a difference between an audit and an independent review. So therefore, here at home, we forgot somehow, that is the DTI in 2008, to say the independent review that we are introducing for other companies that do not want to be audited. We are talking about IFEC, say 2400 and 2410. We can check there to see which one are we talking about. So therefore, here we are talking about an independent review that is not applicable to the companies that are to be audited. That's what we are talking about. So now, we said, let's be clear to Parliament to say we request Parliament to insert this clause that we want an expression to read as follows. For the purposes of this Act, that is the Companies Act, an audit shall not include independent review. But in the draft, people are saying, no, you are amending another national legislation in the absence of that particular department. We are saying our apology, maybe the drafting part of it struggled a little bit, but it is allowed to say, for the purposes of this Act, that's what we need. So we request, therefore, that the clause be amended to reflect what we are describing, to say, for the purposes of the Companies Act, an independent review, an audit, shall mean 1, 2, 3, and then we leave it there. In so much that, therefore, the audit under APA will remain. Yeah. I hope I'm a good teacher. So, a regulation of independent reviewers. The issue of the regulation of independent reviewers. Therefore, if you come from that background which I have painted the scenario, these people are not necessarily to be regulated under IRBA, Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. It is again an agency created by statute under the APA, under the National Treasury or Finance Department. So if one of the comments, the challenge, whatever I described above, and they are saying, IRBA is offering to be the sole regulator for accountants performing independent reviews. It seems as if now there is a common understanding that maybe accountants who are not auditors can also perform an independent review. Now there is that common understanding. So IRBA is saying, please make me a sole regulator. And then here is our response. IRBA is created by a statute. IRBA is created by statute, that is APA, which defines its parameters. To say it starts from here to there. The DTI is of the view that a proper process of consulting stakeholders, including the accountants, should be pursued through the relevant department responsible for IRBA. The Companies Act provides for accreditation processes in this regard. Let me explain myself here. What is happening is that some time ago, the former Minister of Finance, Honorable Trevor Manuel, established a commission. I think it's Langkona, Langkona. To say, please, assist me in the regulation of auditors and accountants. Auditors and accountants. And then the wise people came with recommendation. Langkona, as the chairperson, advise the minister to say, no, we don't want accountants here. Leave them out. We want auditors. Hence, ABA, the Auditing Professions Act, ABA, came into being, leaving the accountants as orphans outside. Now we are here as the DTI. We came with the independent review to say accountants can, under regulation, they can do this work of independent review. Now IRBA is coming to say, please allow me to be the sole regulator of accountants. And then we are saying, I think what I was reading here, is to say there was a process of wanting to club the two professions together through the commission. We never went deeper into the commission. And if now we want, IRBA wants also to regulate the accountants, we think we should revert to that process of the Langona Commission, and then we are properly advised. But here we are saying, please, there is a process, let us not straddle the line. Here we are just asking that the independent review can be performed by people who are not auditors, who can be accountants, but under regulation. That's all what we are saying. So therefore the request, I think, is in a wrong forum. We don't have competency, but Parliament can pronounce on that, but we are saying let's separate these two issues. Thank you. Trading under insolvent circumstances. I will read the comments. The inclusion of trading, that is section 22 in the Act. In the Act is section 22. There is 1 and the 2B, all those issues there. So the comment was saying the inclusion of trading under insolvent circumstances as a prohibition renders all startup companies potentially falling foul of the prohibition due to loan capital being used. So because we say nobody should trade under, nobody must trade in a reckless circumstances. So we are separating. Reckless is prohibited. If you are reckless, we are saying no, you will harm the public. So that is prohibited. But to say under insolvent circumstances, people are saying, do you know that virtually all companies have requested loans in banks? And therefore, they are, in reality, insolvent, in reality. Then we say, maybe, you may be right, but this statute, the Companies Act, is not coming to amend the common law. If we want to amend the common law, like in the Directors' Duty, Section 27 and the like, we will have said specifically to say we want to amend the common law. But we never said that in this Act. What does it mean? It means, therefore, all precedent or all cases passed by our courts to say what is commercial insolvent, what is technical, that still applies. There is a lot of authorities in that regard. Therefore, here we are saying we disagree to say all these startup companies will now be prohibited to trade because in reality they've got loans. But there is a process to see whether somebody is trading in an insolvent circumstances. One, the definition of commercial insolvent and technical is no longer at issue. So if somebody attacks me to say I'm insolvent, then go to court. The court will say this is an irrelevant litigation, and therefore I'm punishing you because you're coming to pay in court. The basis is laid on those definitions. And then we are saying again, the commission itself may find that people are reporting to say, this person is not paying the creditors, so we are being prejudiced. they can send the investigators to look and then come with the report to say, no, no, we come and show reasons why I should not agree with people who are saying you are insolvent, trading under insolvent circumstances. Another issue is to say the commission should have a discretion of investigating the matter. So all these things are there in order not to allow people to go recklessly. The auditor's report, too, if I read the statement, they will say, yes, I've got, like mining, I've got a debt of 20 billion, but I'm servicing it well. This person is servicing, or there is a fraud, they refer it to SARS or somewhere there. Therefore, this issue of generalizing that startup companies, therefore, will be prohibited, it does not hold water. However, we are saying, if in the drafting process, we went haywire a little bit, because they are saying just take away 2B as a whole. We are saying, for certainty, the provision could be revised to avoid the unintended consequences highlighted by the stakeholders, maybe to put a discretionary language, may not trade under insolvent circumstances. That will give us a leeway of saying it is not mandatory, but it's a circumstantial evidence. It's on a case-by-case basis. So therefore, we don't agree. We agree partly to say we can clarify, but not to get rid of it. Otherwise, we are giving a broad license to people to just go and trade under dubious, and that will not be good for our economy. That's all what we are saying in this regard. The use of symbols in company names. There was this issue of saying no way in the world is being used, this and that. It was not time for us to respond then. Today is our time. We are saying, one, the use of symbols in company names is problematic. In some symbols are used for computer language commands and will be costly to implement. So, we are saying the United Kingdom, as we said before, and ourselves, we came with this type of the Companies Act in 2008. For some reasons, the British, they are not good at consulting like us. We overly consult. They pass their legislation. It has got the same provisions of symbols. And therefore, we may go and draw something there to say how are they implementing, what was the reaction of the market? What was the reaction of the market when they introduced these symbols? Maybe the cost may be difficult for us to quantify. So in our response, we also say the United States, it has got 52 states. In some of the states, they have used symbols. It is good to use symbols because the trading name and the trademark, sometimes they don't talk one language. I don't know which good example can I give. You may allow me to use maybe McDonald's, not myself. That M is the picture of McDonald's in so much that it uses that to trade. Probably it's a symbol. And then other nations may also say the Arabs may come with their own symbols. But we'll talk about whether we want translation to the phonetic A, B, C, D up to 26 to translate it to that. But if that is a symbol, it can be used as a trademark and sort of a trading name. Like, is it Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola has got a trading name. Many people don't know. Even myself, I thought it's Coca-Cola, but it has got another. Coca-Cola is a trademark. I will request my colleagues. Is IBI, what is it in full, by the way?
IBI and Organized Beverage Industry.
Yes. IBI, what is it? Yes, that is the trading name of Coca-Cola. But we say Coca-Cola referring to a trademark. So maybe these symbols are moving to the convergence. So we are saying we are on a right track. However, coming to quantify the cost, we may have difficulties, maybe. The Companies Act is progressive in this regard. A preliminary inquiry is that costs for changing systems are not astronomical and are mitigated by the benefits, but the DCR will provide more information in this regard. In order to allow the stakeholders to prepare their systems for compliance, it is recommended that the implementation of the provision be delayed. We don't have time, not that it be removed from the Act. If you say 2 years or 3 years, it's okay, we are at your mercy, but we are saying we should not remove that section. That is our plea. The use of foreign languages in company names. The use of foreign languages in company names is problematic. That was the comment. The DCR disagrees with the comment. The regulations will prescribe the manner and alphabet type used in company names. In terms of the Constitution, certain languages and other official languages must be promoted. Here, in simple terms, is that we have got 11 languages, official ones. But the submission came as if to use, what is it, Hebrew, is wrong. Whereas the Constitution talks about other languages like German, Hindi, Urdu, they should be promoted. And in 10 years' time, I don't know at what level, they may become official. It's another debate, but we are saying we are not restricted to 11 languages. And then these religious languages, Hebrew, they are listed in the Constitution, and I think Islamic is there also. So Khoisan is there also. So all of them, we are saying, let them be used, not only the official languages. But if somebody comes with a Chinese alphabet and the like, 2,000 of them, we can talk about the issue of alphabet type in terms of the Companies Act to say, please retranslate it so that we can understand it from A, B, C up to 26, because coming with something which we don't understand may confuse it. So we have a liberal constitution. We read it to say the 11 official languages are not the only ones. There are other languages to be promoted. So I'm not in the language debate. There are competent people who can talk about that. In view of the above, no amendment is recommended. Access to information of company registers. I don't want to repeat what was said last time, and I think the proponent is here in the room. But let me clarify these issues. I don't know. One, buyer, and then the Companies Act coming with a lesson to say within 14 days, 2, 1, 2, 3. Let me clarify this. As government, the Constitution applies vertically and horizontally. Vertically is solved. Vertically meaning, therefore, if you go to the commission to say, give me this information within 10 days, it is happening. The service delivery is very efficient in that area. So the Companies Act is, we don't have a problem for vertical application to the state. In the area of horizontal, company being requested to say, give me the information, we are saying we agree with the proponent to change and with or. That we agree. But in passing, we are saying if a company of this size is confronted with a deluge of saying, provide this, then that system can be abused. And taking into account that these people are coming to run business, to make profit for the good economy, that may be abused. But we have already considered with the proponent, but we have just advised him to say, this can be abused. So that's all what we're saying. There are definitions here which came really they came to the deal. I'm claiming responsibility here, but it was not intended that they should be in the deal, because we don't have to define everything. Liability asset, there is an international standard. There is also the accounting profession in South Africa. Maybe we were not hit by this financial crisis because they have been there applying this accounting jurisprudence. So asset, liability, creditor distribution, group of companies, holding company, private, fair value, we think they should not be defined. They have been there, court also passed judgment, etc. It has been working. Why do we tamper with something which has been working? So I think that is our response. It's a definition of private companies must be amended in accordance with Section 8 of the Act. But all in all is that these definitions, per se, the industry came with practice. Yeah. Extensions of effective date of the Act. Several presenters are good for an effective date to be moved further than the third quarter of 2010 or target date of 1 April 2011. The legal framework will be ready on 1st of April 2011. Everything is in place, legally speaking. Minister has consulted widely on this matter, and business was being prepared to fine-tune their systems in line with the new dispensation. The implementation was date was moved before at the behest of the stakeholders, that is the third quarter, that is October to December, and then we considered and then we said 1st of April together with the Consumer Protection Act. So we are saying this request should not be entertained. Application of solvent and liquidity test. Here in short is that there is a group of companies, and then a good example here in South Africa is not coming to my mind per se, but let me give you a foreign example. Parmalat, the milk industry, Parmalat. Parmalat is an international company. It has got subsidiaries. In terms of auditing, for auditing purposes, when you prepare a statement, indicate the group, But the jurisprudence in South Africa, whilst you are treating yourself as a group, it doesn't take the independence or personality of that group of companies. A group is a loose conglomeration. But individually, I still have my liabilities, my debt, all those issues. I have a personal legal, a separate legal entity in the group. And therefore, I must abide with the solvency and the liquidity in the group. But when you do auditing, you can club me together with everybody. But if I'm to be sued, a legal person is somebody who can sue and be sued. You cannot sue the group. You cannot sue the group because the group is not a separate legal entity. So Parmalat, what happened? It was liquidated internationally. What happened to Parmalat in South Africa? They said, no. We are an independent, separate legal entity, and then we can pay our debt. We can settle everything. So we are continuing. They are continuing today. But go to ICI, it's an Italian company. It's liquidated out. So therefore, if we are persuaded by this proposition, therefore, sorry, the example which I will give, Old Mutual, it seems as if it's clubbed with, this bank, NetBank or something. Yeah, something of that sort. Now, please, within the context, I don't want to be controversial. So therefore, if Old Mutual is struggling, therefore it means everything. You can sue NetBank and vice versa, and you liquidate everybody. Whereas we are saying separate net bank, it has to pay for its sins, and old mutual for its sins. I think that's all what we are saying here. So therefore, we propose don't entertain this work. Sorry, I think this is the last one. Yeah, so this one, in short, the people were saying the proposed subsection 8B will make any share buyback more onerous, time-consuming, and expensive than what current position is without any benefit. Just to conclude here, we are saying the clause is there to protect the assets so that the directors should not just come and take the assets and strip the company away and strip the capital. If you want to do this, you need a higher resolution, a special resolution. So this is intended to protect the company. However, if there are little onerous, time-consuming, and the like, we are saying compliance per se comes with some issues of saying they should be cost time-consuming. Because if we don't protect this company, it will be stripped off. There are people who are selling assets of companies. I don't want to give example. While the company is still in operation. And we are saying, please go and ask for a special resolution. And therefore, it was intended that there should be that rigmarole of asking for higher, resolution. Ratification of fundamental asset disposal done without the required special resolution. Clause 65 amending section 112.5 provides for the scrapping of the power to ratify a disposal of all or greater part of the assets of a company where the shareholders have not approved the disposal by special resolution as required. Propose that the power to ratify should be retained. The DCR disagrees, as the removal is therefore to protect shareholders by involving them in a fundamental transaction prior to its conclusion. Maybe what I was saying before is striking the line, but we are here to protect the company. So please don't entertain that. The issue of transitional arrangement for audit requirements. The Act abolishes audit requirements for certain companies. The Act does not provide for transitional arrangements in respect of existing companies. Here we say we agree that there is no transitional one. Let me paint a picture. Let me first read it. I will paint a picture. All companies with a financial year and before the effective date of the Act must comply with the provisions of 1973 Act. In other words, say the Act is coming on the 1st of April, but their year end has already come now. Apply, there is no vacuum, so that we should not have a vacuum. Apply the 1973 Act, and then if the Act comes into being in April, you have already 4 months now. Apply that previous legislation, the 1973 Act. Until you are year end in the other dispensation, you don't stop and start again. I think in reality that's what we are saying here. We can read, but it talks about that. So those companies whose year end comes 1st of April onwards, start with a new dispensation and go on. So there is no vacuum. There is no vacuum. We can improve on the amendment. Amendment of clause 23, the reference in subsection 9 to companies' securities register is incomplete and should also include a reference to the central securities depository. I think here there is no issue. We say the DC agrees that the expression company security register should be replaced with uncertificated securities register, or as determined in accordance with the rules of the Central Security Depository, as this expression will cater for both certificated and uncertificated. This is the, what is it, straight submission. And then we say we agree. List of matters requiring special resolution. The list should not be exhaustive, because what is said is that it should not be exhaustive, and they should have a catch-all phrase to cater for any other matter that could require a special resolution. The DTI said, yes, we agree with the proposal. A catch-all phrase can be catered for any other special resolution, whether required by the Act or the company's memorandum of incorporation. Void and voidable. In our presentation, we indicated the difference, that if something is void, it is dead from the time of its inception. If it is voidable, the court can determine. We may not agree as two parties. So the comment is, scrap the provision in the Act as it is in conflict with other sections and causes uncertainty. We say this section seems to be in direct conflict with Section 28 and possibly also other sections as raised by stakeholders. The DTI, that is the request here. The DTI requests further opportunity to confer with the state law advisors in this regard, just so that we rake the whole Act, whether there are conflict, and we are properly advised, and then the Parliament is not misled. You know, we should put things which cohabit with each other correctly. So, in short, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that is the end of my presentation, together with that one of the DDG. The DDG probably would like to conclude, and then thanks a lot.
Chair, thank you very much. I don't think there's any long conclusion that we want to make, but we just want to thank you again for giving us an opportunity to respond to the issues. And again, just to also remind members again that a lot of the issues that were raised by stakeholders, a lot of them, are things that came out of anxiety that suggest that because they do not know what's going to be in the regulations, you know, I think it's an issue of seeking certainty. And I think we must be sympathetic to that. There are certain issues that, for instance, in regard to threshold, you know, there's a fear that the threshold, when they are developed in line with the regulations or as part of the regulations process, it might be that the thresholds become either high or too low. So there's that. Because of the, there isn't any certainty around it, we must appreciate that some of the concerns being raised within that context were actually valid in that sense. But we're saying that the regulations process is continuing, and we will continue to open up the discussions in the same manner that we've done with the amendment bill, in the same manner as we've done with the companies bill when it processed it in 2008. And Chair, we just want to also appreciate some of the stakeholders that have really given direct input and really have taken us through some of these issues and given their opportunity, their time and effort to actually go through with us on this, even in the last minute. And one of those people really that we need to acknowledge is staff itself, the FSB, they have done that. Even the National Treasury, even on the eve of coming, you know, of introducing this bill, we're still engaging with them on these issues. And I think those are some of the things that, you know, though they were raised at the last minute, especially the ones from SARS, we're able to immediately appreciate the concern that we're coming from. Because those are things that when you now look at the practical implications now, when you look at the day-to-day operation, this is what it could lead to. But we do appreciate all the comments, and to say that they have been useful for all of us, and we are not in the business of objecting to things even where things should be considered positively. And we're saying that we should be in a position to properly advise this committee. And when we're not able to advise this committee, we should seek advice somewhere else, which is why in some of the areas we are seeking to confer with the state law advisors so that we can come back to you with advice that is properly articulated and that is substantiated. But Chair, before we close, we are closing, but I would like to give Advocate Miatele an opportunity just to highlight the issue around the convicted persons Because I think that issue needs to be properly articulated so that we are also not misunderstood as a department in terms of what we're saying about it.
Thank you, Chair. Can I request that you take me back to the slided question, please, Donald, regarding the... convicted persons. Perhaps I can just comment, because my comment is about general law, basically, which can maybe assist to explain the situation here. As the DDG pointed out, ordinarily, a criminal conviction endures for a period of 10 years, and when the period expires, it is regarded as pro non scripto, even if it is still written in the criminal record. But in the case of civil matters, usually when a person has been, when the law says that a person is convicted of fraud and therefore cannot act as a director, but again, when the period of 10 years expires, that person would become eligible. But there is nothing stopping the person from, even before the expiry of the period, applying to court to say that he has been rehabilitated, and he points out, for instance, say that he has paid all those monies that he owed and the reasons why everything came about and so on and so forth, and then apply that the court considered. But I think for a private company, a company is a company, even if it's a private company, it endures limited liability. So if a person has been convicted of fraud and he is a private owner of a company, even if he's owner managed, I think that person should be subjected to the same sort of prohibition, and then he should just apply if he wants to apply, and the court will consider his application on its merits. Otherwise, he can just stay as a sole trader, because a private owner-managed company, as a sole trader, then he will lose the limited liability protection, and then he can go like that. And then private people can then complain if he still endures in his misdemeanors. So that's general position. So I think that should assist in trying to understand the way the provision is couched. I don't think that we should go with exceptions. A company is a company, and I think even a person who's a private, who's got a PTY LTD, he should just, if he believes that he's got merit, apply to be rehabilitated before the expiry of the period, if the period is set. If he succeeds, he succeeds. If he doesn't succeed, he can then trade some other help, but does not have to call himself a director of a company because of the previous conviction. That's what I would just like to point out. I don't know whether I got the drift clearly, but I can explain myself if there's a further question.
Chair, thank you very much. We are available for questions.
I think, as we agreed, we would have the tea break after the input by the department, by the responses, and we have, I suppose it's about 20 past 11. We would certainly like to get back here at 20 to 12 so that we can continue then engaging DTI questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Because the companies are doing the audit now. Yeah. And that's, and then the criminal thing is depending on where it's used, your front page is a bit longer. But if you can get, if you can, your lead story can be 5, 6, 6 if it's really big. But otherwise, you're just trying to keep between 3 and 4.
Mm.
I don't think I'm going to sit here for the lead.
I wish I was you.
Mm.
I have to stay for the girl thing. Some of the days have been nice to be here.
Hmm.
You basically just summarize the line for you. You know what?
And, because as I see it now, it's probably quarter two or so. And we're going to take by show of hands a first round. I'm not sure just where the other two are, but let's go straight ahead, members. Can we see by show of hands any questions, clarification, or comment? Honourable Kotze, Honourable Mabasa, so Honourable Harris, in that order.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me welcome the presentation by the DDG on these matters, and it's clear here that they have done some work and perhaps considered a number of areas that were raised. Firstly, I would like to really to comment on the issue of the persons allowed to act as directors. And I think it works in line perhaps with some of the comments raised by the stakeholders that, I mean, this does apply to other laws as well. And one was making an example about if you want to be a lawyer. So, I mean, I think we are not losing anything. Instead, we are being consistent perhaps with the other laws. And the fact that they were able to explain to us that, you know, even if the 10 years has not lapsed, that someone can actually apply. The other question I want to ask perhaps that I was not clear on, perhaps the DG could go to that section 141, the new amendment. It says now, we say it may be referred, and it, I mean, you're removing the word must. I want to some clarity on the may. Perhaps what criteria would would be used to actually refer and not to refer? That would be, I mean, I would really want some clarification on that. On another new amendment, trading under insolvent circumstances, there's an issue that is raised about that is, I'm not clear about. It talks about recklessness. I think you did mention that, you know, people may be regarded as, I mean, should not be considered if they are being reckless. What are the parameters, you know, of recklessness? The word alone, I mean, really, would we define or maybe, I mean, how far do we go with in fact recklessness? And on access to information and company register, I am expecting some other explanation from the DG. For me, I mean, as you say there's not going to be amendment, I do think that some further reasoning behind not amending that, perhaps if the DG could further and elaborate on that one. Yes, thank you. I'll come again.
I think we'll get another round, of course, as well, Honourable Kotsi, Honourable Mabasa.
Let me also express appreciation the input made by the department. The question I want to ask is that seeing that the Act is being amended now, when we have gone from 1994 up to now over a number of years. And I want to believe that, and seeing that one of our most important objectives is development, and in that development, it also means bringing on board or assisting the system. Any system that we work on should also speak to the development, and part of that being, what is the impact of the Act, in as far as it is amended, with respect to people that have historically been excluded from the mainstream of the economy? Does it talk to that? Does it recognize that and try to speak to it? And then the other one is, sometimes there are unscrupulous companies that would not hesitate to, let me use a harsh word and say, rob the people that the company is supposed to serve. Are there any measures that are seeking to prevent or to reduce that? Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Right, Honourable Harris, followed by Honourable September.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to definitely need that second round as well, if you don't mind. There's too many issues on the table. The first one, which is a matter of principle, I think, Chair, and firstly, thank you to the presenters. It was very comprehensive, the presentation. But on slide 25, there's a in the process of opposing the requested extension of the effective date, the department says that the legal framework will be ready on the 1st of April 2011. Now, Chair, I must admit that the legal framework is up to us. We are the legislators, and the legal framework will come from this committee. What's perhaps more important in terms of readiness by 1st of April is the administrative framework. It raises the question whether the institutions that fall under the DTI will be ready to enforce this Act by the 1st of April. So firstly, I'd like a view on the readiness, particularly of CIPRA. Then, Chair, on the disqualified directors issue, which I think is slide 10. Mr. Tenzi said, I believe, that why would you want to preclude somebody from being a director? And I think the answer, from my perspective, is relatively simple. In the same way that you preclude a common criminal from being free for a period of time, you take away his freedom. You preclude him from operating in society for committing a crime. This is why we have this written into the existing Act. The difference between the 1978 Act and the Act on the table are two things. Firstly, the time period in the Act on the table is significantly shorter. I actually tried to ask the legal advisor, but we didn't have time to cover it properly. People are talking about a 10-year period, but by my reading of the Act, the period is actually 5 years in Section 69.9A, and I can't find any change in that in the amendments bill. So if you could just clear up the difference between how long a person may be precluded from being a director as it currently stands. And Chair, my proposal is quite simply that in line with the sentiments expressed by the presenters, we simply impose a lifetime ban on directorships that is subject to judicial review. So you incorporate the judicial review, but you don't say 5 years or 10 years or whatever it is. And then, lastly on that, the 1978 goes into great detail in terms of how the background processes of getting somebody onto that disqualified directors list is meant to work. The new act is totally silent on that. You've effectively cut three pages of relatively new and much needed guidance on how those systems should work, and I don't see any there's no justification for cutting those. Chair, on the issue on page 23, I need this to be clarified for me. The proposal was, this is with regards to the access to information of company registers. The proposal from the presenter last week was that any application needs to take place separately from perhaps a PIA. So change the and in terms of PIA to an or in terms of PIA. The slide presentation says the parliamentary committee is advised not to change the and to an or. But I have heard different views from people in the department. Can I clarify whether the department is suggesting we change the and to an or not? And for two little letters, they have a massive importance in terms of company transparency. And then, Chair, just allow me three or four quick other requests, but I will have to come back. On page 8, it's very sweet, but the department talks about the spirit that every company should prepare annual financial statements. Is it not naive to talk about the spirit of the law rather than legislating for it somehow? And then on page 13. Sorry, slide, yes, sorry. Slide 13. I understand that the department says that regulators must simply apply to the business practitioners, but I think the regulator's concern is that they would have to apply to the practitioners. They don't want to be beholden to the business practitioners. So doesn't that clause warrant further amendment? And then lastly, Chair, I'm interested on slide 16, this rejection of a wholesale approach to exemptions and laws that might trump the Act. How would a wholesale approach look? I don't remember any of the presenters asking for a wholesale approach, so I don't think, I mean, I think the DTI has acceded to the Treasury's request for the MFMA and the NPS to be included, but, I mean, how would a wholesale approach look in contrast to that? And I'll come back later to
you. Thank you very much, Honourable September. And while we're here, Honourable Kamalo, did you want to ask a question? You were just outside the room at the time. No, right.
Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for accepting my apology earlier on. Couple of things. The first one, Chair, I'm a bit disadvantaged in not having the pack of regulations before me. But notwithstanding that, I would suggest that, because I hear what the department says, that, you know, some of the things would be going into regulations. We have our own disadvantage as legislatures when it comes to regulations. I would ask, Chair, that maybe what we should do ourselves, capacity allowing, to look at the proposed regulations ourselves and argue for ourselves why some of them should not be legislated rather than being put into regulation. That's the first one. The other one that concerns me a little bit, the department should maybe satisfy us whether they have conferred sufficiently with several legislation, because this bill does straddle on a number of other legislation, including constitutional matters. So I think they must help us to satisfy ourselves that they have sufficiently do a cross reference on this one. Having said that, I think equally so the clause that I've been spoken about quite a bit on directorship. I think we should not exclude the constitution of the country in this debate, and I think it should be guided by what the constitution says in this regard, other than any emotional proposals in this regard. On that same one, Chair, mindful of the fact that this bill is before the committee, I would think, Chair, we should maybe ask if yourself, if you can't yourself, Chair, do some cross-reference with the Chair of Justice in this matter, so that the committee can have a particular view themselves with regards to the issue of directorship, because we're not alone in this one on that clause. The department should also, I really think it's important, whenever we have legislation, we must satisfy ourselves that this legislation is going to be implementable. We should be reminded what financial plan have been put to roll out this legislation so that we don't have some of these similar problems again. And then second last, Chair, can I find out, with regards to cooperatives, how much have they been taken into consideration in this legislation, co-ops? The last thing that bothers me, Chair, is, and again, we'll seek your guidance here. There are some matters that they said that they are still going to seek legal assistance on. I think maybe equally so, we should do this. We should do it more than them. For ourselves, there are a couple of grey areas that they've pronounced on quite a bit. So that places us quite a bit in a difficulty in the direction that we should take. So maybe, Chair, I think the same, more than the department, we should do that. But Chair, let me end there. Thanks.
We do have the opportunity for a second round, so it's not exhausted at this point from the committee side at all. Right, but at this stage, let's hand over to DTI to respond from to the questions and the comments.
Thank you very much. Obviously, we will share the questions amongst ourselves, but I just want to perhaps just to take this and clear it off. The comment that we made on access to information, we agree with the proposal that has been made by Dr. Milo. It is a typo, and we apologize for that. I thought McDonald did indicate it, but it doesn't look like he was clear enough. So we do apologize profusely for that. We do accept that. But one of the issues that we have raised also with him as well, Dr. Milo, is that how do you balance the potential for such a process to be abused? I think it's good and well when we want to promote access to information, and we think that the committee should consider that amendment, but we think as well that the committee should also consider the balance, so that, you know, when you're asking for information within 7 days from the commission, the company's commission, it is a state institution that got funds. So it would have people that are dedicated to provide that information. Take that and put it in the shoes of a company that is in the business of running a company. Now, if it's faced with a whole lot of requests for information, so let's also think about the extreme situation to say, how do we also in the drafting, how do we balance that? That's the only thing that I think McDonald was expressing in regard to that point, to say we agree with him, but we think that let's also ensure that the crafting also provides for the safeguard. And we will continue to engage on some of these issues, but I think the committee should take note that we agree with that. I'm going to just hand over to the team to to deal with the questions, and I'll touch where they have not covered.
Thanks. I thank Chair and the Honourable Member. Thanks to DG for the protection that I used to teach, but mostly I don't go with a book, I talk. So unfortunately, it's clear that whatever I talk, if it's written, I'm contradicting myself, but the note, take it that the note there, we're agreeing on this issue of information, access to information. Please accept the apology of the DDG. So thanks. The issues of effective date, yes, we agree that it is within the competency of the committee to say we are finishing in August this year. That is within the competency, but we have already requested the agency on this matter, maybe when we introduce the bill. The institution's readiness to enforce the Act, I think that is very important. The DDG, maybe, I'm not refusing to answer this. She will give a narrative, narrative display of facts. Which institutions, in terms of this Act, are in place or are going to be in place by when and the like, just to give you a report, which is another area which maybe will indicate that we are ready to implement the Act. Sorry, DDG, to put you on the that point. The issue of disqualification of directors, it has been raised in so many words to say, is it consistent maybe with the justice legislation in the 1973, probably honorable member, there is, when you say 78, you meant 1973, yes. So, the 1973 Act, I've already requested a book here, to say disqualification of directors, officers, and others by the court.
That's 218.
Yeah, 218, yes. Disqualification of directors and others. Honorable Member, Harris said we cut a lot, maybe two pages as an example, and it's not written yet. I will read the section, but all in all, what we are saying is that this 2008 Act tries to digress from the original position. This chapter, which you are referring to, 2218, it digressed by coming with an exception to say, owner managed, please allow this person not to be, to fall within this definition of disqualification, as an example. So we digress a little bit, and then the probable amendments were coming with something. Then after reflection, reading the 1973 Act, which says, any of the following persons shall be disqualified from being appointed or acting as a director of a company or, except for a body corporate, from being concerned or taking part directly or indirectly in the management of a company, a body corporate, a minor or any other person under legal disability, and it is quoted another act, any person who is subject to any order under this act or repeal disqualifies him from being a director, save under the authority of the court. And then it's a double bent, Roman figure one, an unrehabilitated insolvent, any person removed from office or trust, count misconduct, any person who has at any time been convicted, whether in the Republic or elsewhere, of theft, fraud, forgery, uttering of forged documents, perjury. All this legislation in reality, they are dealing with one type of, of an offense. They are not talking about assault, common assault, GBH and the like. They are talking issues of trust, theft, forgery, lying under oath and the like. So that's what we're talking about. And it is in line with other legislation. Here are the legislation listed to show that the Department of Justice is also in the equation, and another here the legislation as an example. The Corruption Prevention of Corruption Act. That is not the DPI Act, as an example. The Corruption Act of 1992, and then they tried to elucidate it, but it shows that we want to be consistent as one government, talking on the same issue. And then without saying, let's rest our case here, let's consult further, there's no problem. But we are saying, as one government, we are consistent. And Parliament, where possible, should pass legislation which is not contradicting other what we call legislation. So, in short, we are saying we are pleading with the honourable members to say we digress a little bit and went out of the radar of the legislation. Now we are saying allow us to come back from the 1973 Act. I think that's what we're saying. So whether we copied 5 chapters and the like is a drafting issue, but in so few words, we are saying allow us to come back to say when is a person disqualified to act as a director, and then they are listed there. This one might have narrated too much, and then during the drafting, we concede that we can come with whatever, but we must not lose the essence. That is our plea. And then, on the access to information, I'm trying to talk to Honorable Kosi, Directorship, Honorable Harris, at the same time, Honorable September, and the like, but I'm treating them as one. Where I digress, please put me into order. So there is an issue of insolvency, on the issue of corporate risk to business risk, to say, we say remove must and put may. Here is the background. The DDG tried to do that. We are saying this person, the person comes into the picture and take over the administration of the company. So, he or she runs the company. Then there are contracts which some directors entered into without maybe a mandate of the board, as an example, and already tried to defraud the company. So we are saying, if somebody tried to defraud the company, and then this new person, the practitioner, is in place now, and then you say, hey, yes, I think there is a fraud, and then we must cancel this contract. I'm taking it to Mr. Philip Drenger, who was the director who tried to defraud the company. It will defeat the purpose, because he is going to be a judge in his own case. So therefore, we are saying, allow the corporate rescue practitioner, business here, to take over, but there's some administrative issue. Allow him or her to use the discretion to say, this one, there is no problem to repay it to the management to deal with it. But most of the management might have the people who send this company we want to relieve into the gallows and to refer matters to them. It will be self-defeating. So therefore, let's use may discretion. Yeah, that's right. And then my colleagues, whilst I'm still gasping for other issues, may take over. But this issue of reckless trading, to say, why can't you define it? Can you assist me? Reckless trading, can you find out that you define it, because we don't know what it means? Maybe again.
No, I'm suggesting that even as the department or ourselves respond or speak to issues, where we can make reference, just so that we move together to say on or t- taking it from slide 22. Thanks.
That's very useful, and also, of course, the current little booklet, which may well be the, is it the PFA, or which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
The MFA, yeah, company set. Right. We haven't got that little book yet.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to elaborate on the question of reckless trade and the prohibition thereof. The Act is quite straightforward in stating that a company must not carry on any business in a reckless way. In other words, knowing that what you are doing, knowing well what you are doing, would not be to the benefit of the company or your creditors, with gross negligence, or the intent to defraud any person or for any fraudulent purpose. So that the reckless trading is defined in the context of gross negligence and fraud. So if you do conduct your business in insolvent circumstances, well knowing you're not going to be able to pay your creditors, that is termed as reckless trading. And that is what is actually prohibited here. If you trade under insolvent circumstances and your cash flow is fine, you are able to serve your debts as they become due, there is no question of recklessness involved. So this is the part of trading under insolvent circumstances that is actually prohibited by the Act, and that is the intention therewith. So I think that is basically, in short, explaining, and I think our court cases and our judgments in this regard is also to a high standard in South Africa, and everybody basically in the business world knows what reckless trading would encompass as far as that is concerned. Thanks.
Perhaps just to put a spin on the work on the issue of definition. As far as I am aware, the word reckless has not been defined directly, but it is so common in the legal parlance that basically issues are dealt with according to the merits that they present. It's just a wanton conduct that ignores rules without care and so on. But I think it's dangerous to even define it because each matter is dealt with according to its own merits. But it's different from negligence. It's the highest degree of negligence, and it is as Flip is saying, it is to be found in a number of decided cases. The example probably I don't know whether it's a good example where you talk about reckless or negligent driving. You know that in the case of negligent driving, you would not have your license suspended, but in the case of reckless driving, the license would be suspended because it's a higher degree of recklessness. I'm not sure. I just thought maybe it's an overkill, but I wanted to make that point.
Thanks. Honorable Harris also talked about annual financial statements to say they are not so expressed in the Act. Assuming that I'm right, I'm talking to this booklet. It's a Section 30 of the 2008 annual financial statement. Just to give a background, we didn't have something like this in the golden dispensation because the closed corporation used to be governed by the Closed Corporations Act, and then the companies under the Companies Act. Now we are saying all companies, it says each year a company must prepare annual financial statement. So it is expressed in the Act. We are saying, therefore, we are introducing a dispensation, whether you are big or small, there must be financial accountability. So it is expressed here, and then it goes on and then gives categories, but I don't think you want a lecture, but I'm just indicating that it is here. come in on other issues, but there is this issue of don't disregard the Constitution and other departments. I thought when we say we refer to the Corruption Act and the like, in a way, we were saying the Competition Act, where it's another department now, where possible, we also quote it to show that we are very consistent. And then, but let's help each other and then confer with those departments and to find that we talk in one language. But we'll claim that we have already done the Justice Department, they are the ones who prosecute. That's why there is a problem of saying they declare people to be delinquent directors. But you go to CIPRO, as for now, you don't find that that person is included in the database, as an example. And they were running a project called Maredi, or Yamaredi, to say all Supreme Courts, where they declare such people, they must go into the Master's Court, and the Master's Court database will talk to CIPRO's one. It's still a project, it's still frustrating people, but all in all, it shows that these departments want to pass an act which talk one language. The cooperatives in passing, I don't know, my colleagues will come in, but what I know is that here we said not everybody should be audited. You prepare a financial statement, but you go to the Cooperatives Act, you may find that in order to get 1, 2, 3, you need to be audited. But we're saying, oh, but the co-ops, these are people, infant people, which we need to nurture to come to another position. Why do we want an audited statement, which is here being removed? So there is a need maybe to reconcile the Companies Act and the co-ops one. There may be other examples, but I picked on this. Internally, we're talking with the division concerned. We're done. Yeah. Let me say, the development minister, Honorable Mavaso, comes from Limpopo, is Mavaso. Then KZ, then Mavaso, then that I know. Yes. So, development. Development, we try in our level best to say this act should remove all the impediment for the small businesses to enter into the system so that they can get incentives from many departments, including the DTI. But if there is no financial accountability, how to run the training, feeder issues, these companies are just receiving money under the drain. But Parliament in 2008 said, yes, we sympathize with you. Let's say all companies should prepare financial statements of this size, blah, 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 blah. But don't introduce burden, regulatory burden for small businesses. And then we think it is in line with development to a certain extent, but it is not painting the picture of beyond the competency of company law. Within company law is simplification. You come and apply today. Tomorrow you are in the market, as an example. It's a service delivery issue. You go and apply to banks or DTI incentives. They assist you. So we think we are within that regime, within our competency. I don't know. My colleagues will deal with others, but...
Chair, I just want to give some more light on the question of the director, disqualified director's register. The new act, the 2008 act, and the old and the 2073 Companies Act are very much the same as far as the disqualification criteria are concerned. The new act follows the old act in this regard, and I think it's a trusted remedy that is basically followed globally in this regard, so it's not novel to South Africa or new. I just want to refer to the question of periods that was mentioned. Currently, under the 1973 Act, there is no statutory period in the Act. But through practice, the courts have already indicated over the years that they will not favorably look upon any application where a 10-year period has not elapsed since the specific contravention took place or the situation started. So 10 years, between 5 and 10 years is the current period that the courts apply in practice. In the new act, the 5-year period was proposed, and it was basically generally accepted through the comment stage of the act, and people thought it would work. It is a good step in the correct direction, especially in our new democracy, to have a shorter period and to give the courts extensive powers then to intervene and to, in any shorter period, to allow a person to act as director, or even to extend the period of 5 years for a longer period. So I think the regulations in this regard will provide sufficiently for the way that the register of disqualified peoples must be kept. Currently it's done in the 73 Act to a large extent. This will now be done in the regulations, which is basically an administrative situation that needs to be regulated. I think that is about all that I can add there. Just as far as the co-ops situation is concerned, the Companies Act and the Cooperatives Act are not in competition with each other. They try to serve different people in the economy, different situations. I know for fact there is currently an extensive amendment or review of the 2005 Cooperatives Act on its way. One of the aspects that are being looked into is the audit requirement, which is very strict in the Cooperatives Act. They are looking towards lessening the burden there. So I think once the new act is, once the review has been done, one will find that cooperatives are not as rigidly regulated as in the current 2005 Act. Thanks.
Just in conclusion, I think obviously the team has covered all of the issues that were raised. But I just wanted to respond to the readiness of the institution. I think we need to remember the institutions that are being created in terms of this act, and also to note that there is a process to establish these entities. And parallel to that, we have been involved in retraining of staff with this new act already. And we are having our staff get up to implement this legislation. So administratively, in terms of establishing the institution, the processes are way advanced. And at some point, obviously, we could not establish immediately because we had to await approvals from the National Treasury in terms of listing and all of that. But all the other areas have been looked at. And I think one of the things that obviously would come to people's mind is because the ECM system that CIPRO was seeking to procure, which is now a subject of a court process, if it is not ready, will the commission have the right system to implement the legislation? And we can say to you right now that it will have it, because the current system that is in CIPRO right now is being upgraded to cater for that. So that while we are still, because what we're looking at, if you remember what we're trying to achieve with the enterprise content management system, we wanted to get a system that will give us over and above what we have, a system that will also cater for the security features that we would like to have in this particular regard. And as a result, because we are procuring a new system, at the time, the current system was not being upgraded because we were looking at a new system, so it wouldn't make sense to upgrade the current system if you are procuring a whole new system. So we stopped that. But since this matter is a subject of a court process, obviously that process will not be in a position to discuss it with this committee at this point in terms of what are the issues there. But we can tell you right now that the system will be up and running to implement this legislation when it comes to effect. So I think on that score we should be fine. And the processes have been followed, and we are right on track right now, and which is why the minister was confident to advise and announce that the department will be ready to implement this legislation 1st of April. And we acknowledge the point that maybe the industry might not be ready. Even the department itself, maybe the institution might have teething problems, but we don't think that anything extraordinary will happen. We think that we will be ready to implement. In terms of just to clarify also, just to add again, in terms of section 141, Ms. Kozi, we want to draw you again to section 140 itself of that chapter, which gives the business rescue practitioner the management control over a company. Then when you go to section 141, then section 141 says the business rescue practitioner must refer the matters to the management. It's a contradiction in a way. So we're saying that should be a discretion, because section 141 also allows the business rescue practitioner to delegate some of the functions. So that is fine. So it allows for it. So we're just saying that let's harmonize the two provisions, and so that we do not have a conflicting legislation. Just in response to Honorable Harris, you said that the legal framework is awaited from this parliament. I think we do agree with you. But I think the point that you are making is that the Act, the Companies Act, has been passed. So the Act 71 of 2008 has been passed. And we've said it even before as a department. Although we've identified errors, grammatical errors, syntax issues and all of that, we do believe that this Act is implementable. That's what we said at all times. But we said that in the interest of proper introduction of the legislation, we would prefer if these amendments can be addressed by Parliament in time so that when the Act becomes effective, then they can all be implemented. But the process does not mean that the Act is not implementable. So I think on that scope, yes, we agree that we await this process to be completed, and we'll await it to be completed. But the legal framework for the New Companies Act is in place. And this committee is requested to look at the errors that arose in the process and to correct them, so that the department will then be in the position to implement it smoothly, so that we are able to reconcile all the errors that have now been corrected into now the implementation system. And we'll obviously appreciate the committee doing that for us, and because they have already considered and accepted the amendments in terms of just hearing them and hearing us in terms of what is it that we'd like to see. So we will still await this process at the end of the day. The last thing around the, in fact, just to say, around the co-ops, the Department of Trade and Industry has a process of reviewing the co-ops legislation. We'll recall that the co-ops, we don't necessarily club them with everything else because of the special nature that would like to give them special attention. So there is a process of review that is taking place right now, and I think it will be introduced into Parliament, in this committee, if it hasn't been introduced yet. And then in terms of some of the developmental aspects, Honorable Mabaza, I think when we presented in this committee, when we were briefing the committee initially, we did try to address some of the areas that we wanted to achieve through this legislation. And you'll see that one of the key features of it is that it is intended to ease the doing business, to ease the burden on small businesses, but not only small businesses, mm-hmm. to ease the burden on every business that is going to operate. So unnecessary requirements, lengthy forms that are there where people are required to give information that we don't know what the authorities are doing with it, all of those things we're saying we must change. We cannot sit in a situation where we have a whole list, a long list, where companies need to get an agent to explain the form to them. So we're saying, let's simplify everything. This is what this Act is trying to say. To say, let's make entering into a market easier. And then we can deal with the interventions to then, stimulate these companies to then sustain themselves in that market. So, and there are various interventions, like the department has got incentive schemes and all of that, but how do you then incentivize or give incentives to companies that are not even formalized? So we're saying let's encourage the formalization so that even the non-formal sector can be encouraged to formalize and be able to access the benefits. So that's where the developmental aspects come from. And we believe that we'll still be in a position to achieve this. And it will be quicker to register a company. It will be less costly to maintain a company as well. So those are the things that we'd like to look at. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much. We did offer the committee the opportunity for a short second round. I have been advised that the room was only made available to us for one, so we need to be cognizant of the time constraint on us. So we will be closing this at 5 to 1, our particular committee. Having said that, I'm now seeing a looking for a show of hands from the committee members. Honourable Mabasa, Harris, September.
My first question, Comrade Chair, is an overlooked one by the department, where I was saying that sometimes we find there are unscrupulous companies that can take the recipient of their services for a ride. What measures does the new act, I mean the bill, as it develops into an act, take to ensure that such companies are brought to justice, or those that have received a raw deal are assisted? Then my last question is, in consulting, in dealing with amending acts, particularly this one, the SMMEs, have they been particularly targeted for consultation? Because, you know, those are the groups that are very easy to ignore. And most of the time we say, our economic growth is going to come from small enterprises. But if in our practice we don't consciously go out to them, by invitation we will find that only big companies are capable of coming to us. Thanks.
Harold?
Thanks, Chair. The procedures, in terms of the disqualified director, the procedures whereby a disqualified director is added to a registry, what it was pointed out, are in the existing Act, 73 Act, I believe through an amendment in 2004. And it was said that they're going to now be in the regulations. Are they in the draft regulations that we have before us as a committee? And if so, can you point to where they are? Secondly, did the DTI, I can't remember if I've asked this already, Chair, so excuse me if I have, but did the DTI do a RIA on the law? And if so, can we get sight of that as a committee? On slide number 20, the insolvent question, does it not make sense to define it extremely clearly in the law? To my mind, the response from the DTI leaves it relatively open-ended, and I think it would be I would be interested to see if the DTI would then define it technically in the law, or would in absence of that, how do you propose tightening it up without scrapping it entirely? On the next slide, page 21, the Banking Association told us that the cost of compliance was integrating symbols into company names would be, I think, 100 million rand per bank. So we're talking, if they're correct, about ½ a billion rand, if not more. I'm interested in why the department thinks that the costs are not astronomical. To me, that seems astronomical. And then secondly, on the other side of that equation, what are the benefits of having symbols in company names? I don't think the DTI alluded to there being some benefits, but I'm not sure those would warrant ½ a billion rand of expenditure by our banks. Okay, I've got two more, Chair. Okay, the transitional arrangement for audit requirements on page 29, how are we going to formally convey that? It's all very well seen on the slide, but the businesses of South Africa need to get the message formally. And I'll stop there, Chair.
Honourable September, I wonder what Honourable Harris is doing, Chair, by asking the same questions that he asked already. Mine is a quick one to ask whether in legislation or in the regulation, what we do support as the ANC is that we need to make sure that we can have easier access for business into the economy. But it doesn't end there, because many times they have easy access, but there's no sustainability. To what extent does this legislation assist, or is there a comprehensive package of sustainability that's put together in the regulation if it's not possible in the legislation?
Thank you very much. Just the point made by the DTI, DDG, that it was, I think it was slide 32 about the last slide with respect to clause 113, section 2181, that the apparent conflict with section 78.2, etc. Now, that I think we're talking about the void and the voidable, and that you requested more time or another opportunity to return to the committee because you were still consulting your legal people. We need to know just when you were going to be ready in this regard, because we do ourselves have a tight schedule on this. Thank you. Over to yourselves.
Chair, just in the interest of time, I'll just allow McDonald only to deal with the answers, and then I will just sum up.
No, thanks. The transitional arrangement, Honourable Harris, I think what is in the slide is a proposal, but not the real drafting. But the real drafting will be done at a certain stage by yourself, I mean, by yourself, by the state law advisors. So this message which we propose in the slide to say we agree that there is no transitional arrangement, and then this is our proposal, the drafting part of it, it will be done at a certain stage. And then it will be communicated to the public when the bill is published. That's as far as I can respond. Access versus sustainability is a very broad question. I wouldn't like to claim to know what is within the DTI and other departments, but the example of preparation of financial statements, it was an indicator to the DTI to say, we want to help you, we give you money, but and we agree, we assist small businesses, but the aftermath of it, we can't see it. Can't quantify it. Can't we come with this financial accountability and use it as an indicator and say, if you do this, then the incentives are at your disposal if you follow this process and the like. So there are many programs within the DTI through CEDA and the like. As to whether they are effective, really, I think it is also the function of Parliament to monitor that. To monitor that is the function of Parliament to monitor, and we implement. Sorry. So, but all in all, what I'm saying is that there are many programs in government that will, like whether it's in agriculture, agro-processing, all those issues, and then there are incentive schemes. So all in all, we are saying let us see the sustainability of these companies that we're forming, but the Companies Act itself cannot come with all solutions. There are other legislation. Yeah, so that's how I can respond to it. The issue of void and voidable, without preempting the DDG, we are here until Friday. The state law advisors are here. and then they are just a stone throw. I think we can do it within this period. This is just how I'm responding to this issue, and then we'll compare. The issue of defining technically insolvent, yes, we narrated that the courts have simplified that and the like. Why can't we go to the defining part of it? Sometimes defining issues, whereas jurisprudence has already grown, you find yourself now limiting yourself. But can we say we will look at that? We will look at that and see how it is feasible, read together with some leading judgments which are already in place. That's how I can respond. The issue of RIA. Do we conduct RIA in legislation? In this one, when the issue of RIA was approved by cabinet, or when it was still a policy, the DTI is the one organization in government that introduced RIA in all its legislation, and then. I think we take a lead in that. But in the Companies Act, to be practical, we did just a cursory one to say what will be the impact without going so deep like the intellectual property big, which was demanded. It was not done like that, you know. But all in all is that we were conscious in the 2008 one, that there is the issue of RIA. Honorable Mabaso, I think the issue of consulting small businesses, the consultation was done in the Main Act 2008. Here we are coming for technical in reality. The 2008 NEDLAC processes, the small businesses have got a representation there, as whether it's effective or not. GUSA is also a department of small businesses, and NAFCOG was also consulted. The chambers, City Chambers, Johannesburg Chamber of Commerce, they've got departments of small businesses. We consulted with them in the 2008 one. Here, when we said we want to go for technical amendments, we are not reopening issues. We have not gone to the small businesses per se, except the accountants who work with the small businesses, and I think that's how where we are. This issue of saying the scrupulous business people, is it unscrupulous? This is clear. My pardon my English. So I think the Companies Act per se, it is not to come with criminal law issues. The Companies Act, there is investigation which is to be done. As an example, say, the fronting part of it. I will come with the fronting. Be doing business with the fronting is an example which is giving us a problem because it's fraud. This is fraud. The issue which we're talking about, creditors and the like, this is fraud. So we describe how people should be disqualified if they are involved on unscrupulous activity in the area of SME fronting, the issue of the Consumers Act is another area where you mislead the public on quality. Like the Consumers Act deals with that. In short, I'm trying to say, there are other complementary legislation which may assist the Companies Act, but we may be weak in the enforcement part of it, maybe the issue of fraud in relation to the issue. we have not been active, but we need to go that route.
Okay, if we can just be quick, because the, I think the time for the committee is...
Can I just
speak
in here, DDG?
There is an outstanding question that Honourable Harris wanted to ask, and you may as well address it right now. But I'm going to appeal to you, Honourable Harris, no preamble.
Excuse me, Chair. The issue relates to the section of the Section 218 of the 73 Act, which Mr. Nchitenzi quoted at length earlier. I've had an engagement with parliamentary questions with the Department of Justice, who claimed that Section 218 of that Act, and I quote from their reply, deals with civil actions and does not deal with criminal convictions. Now, I had a discussion with the Chair about whether we could consult the Department on their view on this.
Chair, I think let me just perhaps request the indulgence not to respond directly on that question right now. Like we said, that we still on some of the matters we're still engaging, especially on that aspect around the directorship, the disqualifications. We said that we request an opportunity to go and confer with the state law advisors, and we'll confer with our counterparts in justice. But I think the principles we've already indicated in terms of how the courts are approaching it right now, how it was under the 1973 Act, and where we think that there may have been a move from the 1973 Act, and how we think that it can be ameliorated. But I think we'll request the opportunity to come back when we come back on some of these issues, Chair. Chair, just to I think McDonald has covered these issues. We find ourselves often, I think, Honourable September, I'm trying to address you on this one in regards to the access, you know, because the sustainability of these businesses, because easy entry does not necessarily mean, you know, you'll stay there. But you see, the company legislation actually facilitates the entry. So it facilitates entry, it regulates the exit, it does all of that, and make it easier for you to then start running a business. One of the things that we found is that all the time,